why I think it would be interesting to consider whether it makes sense to promote the initiative of a nuclear test-free zone in the Middle East, which essentially means all the countries in the region ratifying the CTBT. The funny thing is that, well, all the countries should win. Egypt would be reassured that Israel does not go further, doesn't go beyond the red line of testing nuclear weapons. For Israel, it would also give an assurance that Iran is not going beyond that. Egypt, Israel, and Iran objectively would have a benefit from such a nuclear test-free zone. However, for different reasons, none of them is going to suggest that. Egypt, because they reject anything which is less than a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. They have been advocating this for so long, 36 years, that they're now not going to consider anything less than that. Israel will probably not consider it favorably because they will consider that it's a distraction from the real issue, which is the Iranian nuclear program. And Iran will not engage in such a nuclear test-free zone because they cannot even talk to Israel, which they don't recognize. So you are in this strange situation that something which is in everyone's interest will not be proposed by those who would benefit most. So the question is, shouldn't other states, the EU in particular, and Turkey, which wants to play a role of mediator in the region, take the initiative and say, let's try as a first step to a nuclear weapons-free zone or weapons of mass destruction, start with a nuclear test-free zone, which is really adhering to the CTBT. So that's the answer to this very difficult question. Thank you.
Mark, you want to add or any other topic, and then we'll have second round.
On Pakistan. To get to your question, Pakistan and the summit vis-a-vis Iran was not a player at that meeting. So they didn't figure. Pakistan was a player. And as Pierre suggested, the issue in Pakistan at the summit as well as outside the summit is the situation regarding Pakistan's strategic nuclear assets. And during the run-up to the summit, there was a great deal of concern about how the Obama administration was going to play this, simply because in recent months there's been a lot of discussion about whether there would be a U.S. role for somehow increasing the security of those assets in Pakistan under the last developments of 6 months or so that is engendered in Pakistan an almost existential angst that the U.S. would somehow go into Pakistan and take its nuclear weapons away. And the Pakistanis have become allergic to any discussion about the security of their nuclear assets, which led, I think, the summiteers on the Western side, particularly those who are engaged in discussions with Pakistan, with China, with India, Afghanistan, and Russia about addressing security issues in South Asia, this group of states was rather reluctant to push that issue to the brink at the Nuclear Security Summit, in part because these issues are under discussion already and they're subject to a very delicate security dialogue that's going on between the U.S. and Pakistan right now. So there was a reason to keep it off the agenda. I'm given to understand that in the closed-door meetings that took place during the summit, Pakistan, supported incidentally by India, expressed concern about the prospect that nuclear security issues would somehow inhibit their nuclear weapons security by getting, you know, moving into the area of their strategic area to behave by themselves and to act autonomously in their nuclear weapons deployment. So the Pakistanis were objecting to certain areas here during the summit meeting, and they made very clear they did not share the entire agenda of the meeting.
Well, thanks. I said we've got time for round two, so who wants to shoot first? Over there, please, sir. And then, Alex, you're next.
Yes, I am Louis-Victor Bril from the European Commission. I'd like to have your reaction on three questions. Sorry for three questions. First, it's let's make a few parallels between Iran case and other case. First, I will say about the pride. I have heard the pride word. I remember that in the 70s, in some of the nuclear weapon states, it was a real pride to have them, let's say France, for example. Let's say the race between US and Russia was based, not mainly, but partially at least, on the feeling of pride in their population. So I would be very happy to have some of your reaction on that. Secondly, about Russia. If Russia today would not have nuclear weapons and would not have a seat in Security Council, what it would be on the strategic importance of Russia? Let's think, I would say, on negative side here. It means this can be an input for understanding what Iran may want to achieve by having or trying to acquire capacity to make a nuclear weapon. The third, third part of the first question is, let's examine those countries which have abandoned the acquisition of nuclear weapons. Well, South Africa is well known, but there are other ones, and Brazil and Argentina have ceased their race toward that. However, for example, Brazil is very cautious to have those, let's say, proof that they are able to master nuclear deterrence, not speaking about enrichment, but speaking about their ability to launch satellites or to have a nuclear submarine. So this is my first question. Let's compare with other countries along these...
Your questions are absolutely brilliant, but if every one of your questions is broken down into three sub-questions, we're not going to have much time. So
sorry,
you will forgive me, and I'm certainly not being rude, but if you could present your other two questions as simple questions, that would be good, and then we'll have other people asking as well.
They are very rapid. The fact that Pakistan does not belong to NPT does not make him less dangerous than Iran. In absolute way. Here I have some, I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on that. And my last question is that we cannot regularize those who have acquired a weapon outside of the NPT, of course, for the time being. What do you think about the possibility to regularize with all the quotes necessary inside the development of a new FMCT, who is taking place now? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for the questions. Alex, please.
I have the time very quickly. I'm Alex Papayan from NATO. Three very brief questions on Iran internal politics.
With no sub clauses?
None at all, or one question with three sub clauses, if you allow. First of all, let's imagine that Mousavi was allowed, let's say, to win the elections last June. How would this affect the nuclear program? The second, which is related, is to what extent does Ahmadinejad has any control on the nuclear program and how seriously we should take his statements, let's put it like that. And finally, is brain drain an issue delaying the nuclear program right now?
Okay, Alex, thanks very much for three succinct questions. Looking at the clock, we're obviously not going to have time for a third round, and therefore, as this will be the final chance, does anybody else want to ask one single question? Please, go ahead. Thank you, that's an extremely good question. Hopefully we'll be able to write your speaking notes, draft speaking notes for you this evening. Fabrice, what did you want to say? Something brief?
Yes.
Go on.
Yes, I just wanted to ask particularly Mark about the non-aligned countries and whether their current position on all those issues are driven by real concerns about the NPT, or whether they're also driven by high politics and a certain breed of new anti-Americanism or anti-Westernism, which we start seeing emerging both in Asia and also in Latin America. Thank you. Okay.
And I apologize for this, but I'm also cannot resist just one question, which is on Iran. We have obviously the United States, which historically wants to limit the number of nuclear powers in the world. Because the nuclear club is a prestigious club, and therefore the more people that join it, the less prestigious it becomes. Secondly, of course, because proliferation could lead to a much more dangerous world. But what about the attitude of Russia and China, particularly as it comes out of the Iranian dossier? Are they less concerned about proliferation? Do they see it as less of a threat to their security? Are they more egalitarian at thinking that it's good that everybody should have the bomb, or that, you know, the consequences would not be as grave as the US believes? Or is it really a question that somebody implied that they're sort of playing this game because it's a good way of sticking it to the United States, but as it gets to the end game and they see that Iran is really getting close to acquiring a nuclear weapon, they suddenly think, well, you know, it's fun to poke the United States, but at the end of the day, is it really in our interest to have a nuclear-armed Iran? And therefore, they'll rally, if you like, to a more hard line, sanctions, etc., even if it's at the 11th hour. That's the question. Sorry, but I couldn't resist. Forgive me. Anyway, we've got 15 minutes for this schmozka board of final questions. We'll reverse the order. Mark, would you like to go first this time?
Okay. Oh, sorry. It is historically driven by real concerns about the future of the NPT. There's no question about it. These concerns go back many, many decades. But we have, in fact, seen a polarization of this issue in recent years. It's been pointed out to me that the NAM, which has been active in Geneva and active in New York for many years, only very recently established a chapter in Vienna. This happened at the end of a long, very negative relationship in many respects between the United States under the Bush administration and the IA led by Mohamed Abarday. I don't have to reiterate the milestones of that relationship, but it would be fair to say, in fact, that high politics are extremely important here in this. As I said before, at the working group level, there's a lot of interaction between Western states and NAM states to address technical issues. But at the high level of politics, the decision makers don't get it. They don't have any of that information. They're driven by a rhetoric which is somewhat self-reinforcing. We've heard Sharon was saying that, in fact, that one of the issues that may be contributing to this is the fact that Egypt in recent years has been losing power in the region. And when that happens, then it's possible that the Egyptians may be relying on this rhetoric to maintain their status quo position vis-a-vis other states in the Arab world. But there's no question that we've seen a deterioration of relations between the West, the EU, the United States on the one side, and many of these actors on the other side. We're seeing that in Turkey. Turkey is a country which has a nuclear energy ambition. It's not clear, however, where that program is going to develop. At the same time that Turkey has tried to start a nuclear power program, it has taken some decisions affecting high nuclear politics, which have displeased the P5. Turkey has not been cooperating with the P5 on the issue of Iran and sanctions. This is the case of Turkey is just emblematic here in this regard. But I think it can be said that a great deal of damage was done to the climate in the Board of Governors and at the NPT review conferences and prep conferences in general by the confrontation between the Bush administration and the IEA Secretariat. There's no question that the NAM perceived Bush as moving in a unilateral direction, ignoring their concerns. He was no longer perceived as, the U.S. was no longer perceived as being committed to the three pillars of the NPT. The interest in disarmament was eroding. After the 9/11 episode, President Bush launched an initiative to, in fact, try to dissuade non-nuclear weapon states in the NPT from obtaining technologies for uranium enrichment and reprocessing. This was a very, very good idea, which unfortunately in translation in the Bush administration was portrayed as a matter of preventing countries from developing their technological wherewithal. That became magnified by the NAM in the debate, and we had to deal with this for a long period of time during the whole Bush era, and it's played out right until the end, until 2009, when proposals that were put on the table by the IEA, which were in fact very beneficial to the NAM states, to set up a fuel bank and a system of guarantees to make sure that if supply of nuclear fuel would be cut off to them, that they would have access to nuclear fuel regardless of political actions taken by their adversaries. These were all very good actions, but because the climate during the Bush era was so poisoned, right to the end, into late 2009, the NAM states failed to approve this proposal, and the IEA to this day is dealing with the legacy of the poisoned relationship between the U.S. government and the IEA during that period.
Well, thanks, sir.
Yes.
But the fewer you answer, the more Sharon has to answer. So
sure.
Remember your colleague.
Well, although Sharon is certainly going to deal with the question about Mousavi and Ahmadinejad, I would just state what I think. I think if Mousavi had won the election, it would have changed nothing from the nuclear weapons program. On the contrary, I think Europe would have thought that it's much easier and better, we can deal with them and give more time to diplomacy. But I think he would have been unable to, even if he wanted to make any concession, it would have been politically suicide. And so I think we would have thought that it's better, but it wouldn't have been. And what's the role of Ahmadinejad? Well, I think, of course, Ahmadinejad cannot decide on the nuclear policy alone, clearly not. He can express the view in different ways, and I think the way he have done, expressed the opinion on the nuclear program, on denying the Holocaust, on aggressing Israel, has been in fact very counterproductive. And so I think, yes, Mousavian would have done that much better. And the program might be even further advanced than it is today. But I'm curious to see what the other speaker will say. Ashton, it's too late to ask the question. You have to do that earlier. She's leaving after tomorrow. The FMCT for Pakistan, yeah. Well, you know, the problem with the FMCT and Pakistan blocking, in fact, any progress on the FMCT is partially, at least, a reaction to the US-India deal, which clearly favors India. And they, Pakistan say, as long as you don't, if the FMCT, as long as the FMCT doesn't deal also with the fissile stockpile, we are not going to agree on anything. And we know that this is a non-starter, because if you want to progress stepwise, you need an FMCT saying we stop new production of weapons material and leave for later the question of reducing the stockpiles, which is a much more difficult one. So by understanding, we can all understand Pakistan's position, but this is a consequence of the Indian exception that was even agreed by the NSG, which is a terrible thing. Jamie, I mean, your question is extremely difficult. Are Russia and China less concerned than the US about non-proliferation and more nuclear weapon states? It's a difficult one.
Frame of reference.
If I had to say yes or no, I would say yes. They are less concerned, and they see short and medium term advantage in playing it the way they are doing. The only good thing about Iran is that the interests of Russia and China are opposite. Russia would love Israel to bomb Iran, because that for sure first would push the barrel of oil above $200 a barrel, which is the thing China fears most. So there they have opposite interests. And Russia would be called to play a role, a mediator role in the Middle East, which I also would love to. So from a cynical point of view, I don't think Russia in the short term wish to see any solution there. China, it's not true. China, in the case of Iran, they on the contrary, they don't want sanctions because they don't want to undermine their oil supply from and gas supply from Iran. And so it's a question of money. And the EU is very cautious because also they have economic interest in Iran. And so that's why we say it. But in North Korea, we've seen the failure of China. And again, they fear less having North Korea having nuclear weapons and the regime remaining in place than having the regime fall and a unified Korea Peninsula, which would be under the South Korean umbrella and U.S. umbrella, and as long as the U.S. is supporting Taiwan, they are going to support North Korea, whether or not they have nuclear weapons. So it's very complicated. Thank you. Yes.
Well, you know, they don't value non-proliferation as much as they value bilateral relations. And that was also true of the United States when it turned a blind eye to Pakistan, when Afghanistan was invaded. So having said that, I think that China must be concerned about proliferation in Japan. It's not completely oblivious to it, to proliferation. But in the short term, I think they're much more interested in the bilateral relationship and the tying down of the U.S. I don't think there's a grand strategy of multipolarity, promoting multipolarity in that sense. I think it's much more short term. On other precedents and status and so on, you know, I'm surprised you want to sort of justify what some people have or are doing to sort of justify what other people do. I mean, that Brazil might think it'll get status from having a nuclear capability. Perhaps it does. All I know is that at least three countries, Israel, France, and Britain, who must wonder what on earth they have nuclear weapons for. Israel, in a sense, has provided the alibi for the Iranians to go down that road. Israel is conventionally strong. When it went down this road, it wasn't. It was really in danger. It felt in danger of being thrown into the sea by 100 million Arabs. Subsequently, we found out that Israel could defeat the Arabs with the help of American arms, conventionally, but it has no answer to the various intifadas and insurgencies that take place. The nuclear weapons are virtually useless in any contingency you can think of, except other nuclear weapons, which they've provoked, in a sense, or they've justified. England and France, they've been looking around for a rationale for nuclear weapons since the end of the Cold War. Britain, even today, Clegg and others argue that we're not spending money on the regular forces, which will be used, and do we need a trident? Do we need three tridents? How much should we spend on the nuclear program? What's it for? Who's it against? And so on and so forth. So I really don't think that it's very hard once you get there to give it up. There's a sunk cost, there are institutions, there are bureaucracies and so on. But I don't see the argument that because some countries have gone down the road and come back, or that France and Britain, and Britain had the top table argument, as you remember. The argument for nuclear weapons was that Britain wanted to sit at the top table. France's argument was after Suez, having been ditched by the Americans. They didn't want a repeat of Suez. They wanted to go down that road. And you may recall, France was the primary provider of Israel. But I don't see that, let's say, erroneous policies. If you think, as I do, that a world without nuclear weapons is desirable, it may not be easily achievable, but it's desirable, then I don't think opening the door to new entrants is a good idea. And I don't think that drawing parallels between what other people did before, which were mistaken, to justify what other people should do now is very helpful. All right? Intellectually helpful or practically helpful. I'm not going to get into the discussion of what difference it would make if you had the so-called moderates or the Greens in Iran as opposed to the current group. I think it would make a lot of difference. It would make a lot of difference. Again, it's a question of how you formulate it. Are you asking the Iranians to stop their program? They won't stop their program. Are you asking them to become your servants because they're democratic, quasi-democratic? They're not going to. They're going to be very difficult customers, whoever runs the country. But you would have more assurance of a responsible, transparent system in the critics of the regime that you hear, whether it's particularly Karoubi, but Mousavi and Khatami, than you do under the current system. And that's what it's all about. It's not about technology. If it was about technology, we'd be raking Japan over the coals. It's about trust, transparency, reassurance. We have no assurance what the Iranians are going to do, what they say, based on the record of their behavior and their actions. If they change that behavior and actions, one could imagine that certain technologies, which we don't want them to have now, would be permissible. I've always believed that I'm not a fanatic arms controller. This is an issue of politics. It's an issue of trust and transparency in behavior. If Iran was a status quo power, taking responsible positions in the region rather than trying to kick the West out and benefit from conflicts. If it were, I won't say on the West side, I'd say an independent state of a certain responsible policy, one would have far less worries about enrichment, how close they are, how far they are. This is what it's about. So yes, politics make a lot of difference, and the people who want an accountable government and an honest government, in the sense, I don't mean of financial corruption, but I mean honest representation. Yep. Wrong, and one of them, apart from oil price slides, I'm sorry I haven't answered your question about defections or brain drain, that there are things that could slow the program down, that might slow the program down, that might change the cost calculus, but in my view, a change in the succession, the change in the supreme leader leaving, dying, will create a real impetus for the Iranians to make a decision. They're very bad at making decisions. And one of the decisions might be on this as well.
Sharam, Pierre, Mark, I think on behalf of everybody, thank you very much. I'd also like to thank Fabrice and Fabrice, your colleagues, your team at Carnegie, for organizing tonight's event, producing three extremely interesting speakers. That's not said with protocol in mind. That comes from the heart as well as from the head, even more from the head than from the heart. I'd also, of course, like to thank everybody for coming this evening. I said at the beginning you had to sacrifice 1.5 hours of the most rare and precious commodity in Brussels, sunshine. But I think you'll all agree with me that it was worth it. I've learned a lot. I'm sure you've learned a lot as well. Thanks again for giving us your time. And could we have a round of applause for the three speakers? Class dismissed.